It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back, KFAR listeners. We're on the air with another episode of Alaska Tracks, the program where we listen to excerpts from interviews I've recorded with pilots and trappers and hunting guides from all over the state. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'm the host of this program. Last week, we started listening to our interview with Larry Critchin of Cordova. There weren't too many outdoor activities that Larry didn't get involved with. He tried and mastered them all. He's got lots more stories for you today, so let's get started.
I saw a mink get caught in a trap once. We had this bridge, and Jimmy checked one end of the bridge, and I look at the other. So I was just looking down. I saw something under the water. It was open water at the time. And it crawls right out, and it goes right up in the cubby and got caught. I yelled at Jim, I just saw a mink get caught. I can't believe it. We had a box in the car, so I went and got it real quick. It was a female, and she wasn't hurt, and I put her in the box. So we brought her in. I went out to the old mink ranch. I got a big mink cage, and we put her in there. Then we caught a male. So this guy, we had a big arm, he said, you can't raise mink because they'll kill them. But anyway, we bred them, and we had a litter of kits. I didn't know anything about mink, and I went out there one day, and there's about three baby mink. They fell through the chicken wire, and they're laying dead. But I heard some squeaking in there. So I changed the setup. I put some screen in there so that couldn't happen again. We could hear him squeaking. When he got, I don't know, a couple of weeks, I looked in there, and there he was, and he had his eyes open. So I brought him in the house, and we started playing with him. The mother didn't like that a bit, though. She'd take it back, and she'd grab him and scold him. But anyway, we kept playing with that mink till he was full grown. And we called him Maxie. He would run around and play, and I could whistle, and he would come back. He was really neat. Jimmy would go and pet him every morning. We'd go trapping. He's out here in the cage. So one time in the spring, we're trapping beaver. It was breeding season, and Jimmy came. I was just going to yell at him, don't pet that mink. He used to scratch his ears. And he stuck his finger in, man, that mink nailed him, and Jimmy ripped his hand out. But anyway, that's the only time you couldn't mess with him. Around breeding season, you better look out. Another time I got bit by him. So we took him across the sound, we were setting in over there. He kept him over there all summer. Put him loose in the grass, and I whistled, he'll come back, but the grass is about that high. And he couldn't see me, and so I finally got tired of trying to get him back, so I just reached down and grabbed him out of the grass. Man, he nailed me, because he didn't know it was me. Then we had a pet raven for years here, too. It used to sit on the porch right outside our kitchen here. He'd gotten so much trouble, I finally exiled him to Hawkins Island. A friend of ours lived over there. And then he'd fly right back. They took and clipped his wing. But he used to go in people's second-story window and wreck their houses around there, tear up motorcycle seats. And
what was his name?
Hoppy. He was really something else.
You talked earlier about seal hunting.
Yeah.
Let's go back and talk about what were your techniques.
When we were delivering oil, yak could tag, I'd shoot them in the surface, and most of them would end up on the beach. Then we were at Augustine Island, the lagoon up there. It was a real shallow lagoon. There were millions of seals up there in that lagoon. So, and I didn't have a boat, but I could shoot them. Most of them would end up on the beach. I never shot a lot of them, maybe 30, 40 or something in a week. Jimmy shot way more seals than me. Ed Bilderback, one winter, he had 1,600. And Jimmy hunted sea lions, too. One of his trips, I think they had 400 or 500 sea lion. They'd go ashore in these rookeries and shoot them with a 22.
And there was a bounty on them then, too?
No. They sold hides to Germany, and I used to buy them, too, and I forget what the heck I paid. It seemed like they're worth about $15 a piece. But there's a difference in money now. I used to buy a few big sea lion hides, too. And then you had trouble with the big bulls, too. I never did it, but Jimmy told me all these stories. Those big bulls come after you a little bit, bluff you probably, but, you know, they weigh tons. Found out you had to watch out for them. I did all the skinning of beaver. That's where I learned how to skin seals, probably. I could do a blanket in 5-6 minutes clean. I try to show kids how to do that, and they can't do it. I did all of skinning a beaver, and he did all the stretching. And all he did is scrape the oil out of them, and he made perfect circles, you know. And
well, what's the secret?
It's the knife, probably. That real butter fat on the belly. As soon as you get past that, I just take 2-inch cuts down the meat, leave the meat on, take the meat off, leave the meat on, take the meat off, and you just go through them like nothing. I don't know how, I can't explain it. I haven't skinned a beaver for a long time. I think last one I skinned showed some kid, it took me maybe 15 minutes. But like wherever, you could skin seals, because after you skin them for a while, it's simple. I mean, it doesn't take any time. There's some Eskimo lady in Kodiak used to win all these Olympics for years. Finally, she skinned a seal in 5 minutes, and she still won, but she says, I'm so slow, I'm getting old, she said. And I read about these brothers skinning 10 muskrats in 2 minutes. Well, Weber and I, we trap rats. There used to be quite a few rats here. And then they died out completely until there wasn't even a rat around here. Well, one winter we got bored and we're waiting for beaver season to open. So do you know where that gazebo is out of mile 10?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that pond, Jimmy and I decided to trap it. So we had about 20 traps. This first day we set it, we caught 70 rats that day. We'd put a trap and a pop-up, and then we'd cut a willow. Before you got the willow in the ring, the trap would spring, you know. I think one set there, we must have caught 7 or 8 before we ever got a stick in the thing. So we had 70 rats. We didn't even have any pack boards because we didn't dream of that. So we split one tail, and then we lace all these on, carrying by one tail, and it worked to a fashion. Anyway, we caught 500 rats out of the pond in 2 weeks, and we quit. John Gorse, an old vlogger out here, he trapped muskrats, and he was really a good muskrat. He really went gung-ho. I think he had 2,500 one winter out here. He told us, how long does it take you to skin a rat? Jimmy says, oh, it probably takes us 3 minutes. He says, how come it takes you so long? He says, now tell me how you do it. So we told him, we split across the back legs, and we start the hide down. Then we get to the front legs, and we pull them through, and then we get to the head. And we get the knife, we start cutting the ears. He says, there's where you're losing your time. You don't cut the ears or the eyes, around
just
the eyes.
Pop them off?
Right. Did you ever do it?
No.
Okay, John says, you just go like this about 5 times, so. And then you go pow, and they'll come right on. And they do. But every once in a while, you pow up and you pull a head off, you know, or something, or rip it. So Jimmy and I never did it, but it does work.
We just loosen it up by twisting it around.
Right. It just, I don't know what it, you just go like that, and then pop and it'll come right off. Pops the ears and everything. But anyway, once in a while, like I said, it screws up, so we quit doing that. We had this cabin at mile 14, so we have all these rats in there drying. We had mice all over the place, and we get in the sleeping bag at night, and here our sleeping bag be full of little pieces of muskrat flesh because the mice would pack it in there and hide it. And Weber would set snares all around the cabin for mice.
Now there's a real trapper.
You'd spend an hour when we should be doing something else, making a snare for a mouse. The sound was usually open 1 year and closed the next for trapping, and it wasn't ever like that out here on the mainland, I mean out the road. But I had one friend, it was a high line trap, Jack Birch. He would trap here on the open year, and then next year he'd go down in southeast and trap there. And down there, he'd catch a couple hundred mink, and he was really a super otter trapper. He'd usually catch close to 100 otter out here every year. One time he had to come to town because his boat couldn't handle them all, and he had about a 35-foot boat, so he had 120 otter, I think. So he had to come in and take care of him in town. I trapped beaver with him 1 year when Jimmy was in the Army, and he couldn't skin a beaver. It'd take him 40 minutes to skin a beaver, but he could skin 5 otter while I skinned one. One time I went down to see him in the evening, and after dinner, I think he did 9 otter in about an hour. And when he got done, they're as clean as this. His secret was a sharp knife, and he just knew how to do otter.
Yeah, because they've got a real reputation of being really hard.
They are. Weber and I, the first one we ever skinned, they took 2 or 3 hours. After a while, there was nothing to it, but it's still hard. They're still one of the toughest things there is. We skinned everything in this house. Everything was skinned in here, wolverine and foxes. I have 2 rings there years ago where we hung up coyotes, and I skin as many as probably 18 coyotes in a day here. But my worst thing is those coyotes were shot from airplanes. I used to buy them in the round. The guys were hunting for bounty, so Jimmy and them guys. And you know how many you can get in a Super Cub in a gunner? You can get 18 coyotes in a Super Cub. I got a picture of a Super Cub with 18 coyotes laying out alongside of Jimmy and gun. But he was really super shot from an airplane.
Now that had to be really hard. They shoot him with a shotgun? Or?
Yeah. He has a 10-gauge double barrel, and he plugs one barrel and just uses that single shot. Jimmy's a good shot anyway, but he proved it because they used to come in with a load of coyotes and a few wolves.
They'd just get him off the Delta?
Yeah, and they'd go clean down to maybe as far as Cape Yakutaga. And some of those coyotes got really smart, too. After you make a pass and miss them once, boy, sometimes you can't ever get them again. They're pretty smart. They'll crawl in driftwood. They'll go out in the surf. As soon as they hear that plane coming, they're gone.
What about Martin? What do you think happened there? What changed?
I have 1929, maybe earlier, Alaska trapping regulations. And I noticed in there that back in the 20s, Martin was worth a lot of money and everybody was trapping. So they had limits on them in certain areas. I noticed 10 or something, and they had to be sealed. What I think is that maybe they really overtrapped because they were worth a lot of money and they just wiped them out. Only place where Martin around here when we were trapping is down at Kushtikaw Lake and Martin Lake. There was a few Martin down there that people could actually go down and catch them, 20 or 30. And there was a few on Kayak Island that were planted there back in the 20s. But there was always a few on the Sound. At the same time, you could go down the head of the bay, maybe catch half a dozen. The whole Sound had a few, not a lot, not like this. Well, Jimmy, when he caught them otter on the Sound, I think he caught about 50 Martin. And he wasn't trying to keep away from the mink, but I think he still got 60 mink, too. And the same way with my boy out here, he's trying to make mink-proof Martin sets because he doesn't want the mink. But the mink are coming back, the price, a little bit, I noticed. As soon as they show up, the mink sort of disappear. We think that maybe the Martin kill them.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your fur buying.
When Weber and I first started trapping, we sold the Sears and Roebuck. We did really good with them. They'd send you a wire right away, you know. And we did good until they quit, and then we started experimenting around. I used to buy fur for Moss and Stephan, the whole fur company.
Out of where?
St. Louis. When I went to buy a mink, I knew a mink was worth $30. Okay, so I could pay 28. I knew I was going to get 30, but I already knew when the season started what I was going to get. You know, there was no question. So that's the only way I could make money. I still sell a lot of Eskimos, but I'm tapering off. They really want seals, and I don't panel them anymore. The only fur I got now is a few beaver and some marten, a few mink. But we used to go to auctions, too. We used to go to Seattle at least twice a winter. And one year, I got the top prices on any otter that were sold down there. If I picked these otter, I'd maybe have 80 or 100 otter, and I would put them in lots for mats for coats and stuff. When otter were going for 50, we'd get 150 for them.
Just because they were so well matched and top quality.
And I knew how to do it. And as a matter of fact, last time we were at Seattle First, there's some guy wanting to buy some shearing beaver there, and the guy that was running the place didn't know anything about beaver. So he asked me if I could find him some good beaver. Then the last time we bought a lot of beaver there, it was made me sick. They had 10,000 beaver, and there was only me and a couple other people were even bidding on it. And I bought some really super mediums for $1 a piece, Alaska beaver. I bought blankets for $7.50, $10 just several years ago. It made me sick. I brought them all back to Alaska.
As usual, Larry has a story for every occasion. I appreciate the way he can laugh at his mistakes and not brag, at least not too much, over his successes. Time for us to take a commercial break. If you enjoy this program, please be sure to thank our sponsors the next time you're in their business. For now, back to our interview with Larry Critchin of Cordova.
We had these old army parkas, and we usually had a piece of Bisqueen we'd take with us, and that's about it. We did have an old coffee pot to make hot water, and we had a cache that's under a bunch of rocks where we kept all our Bisqueen and coffee cups and stuff like way back on some of these slides where we used to hunt goats. But anyway, we'd go back there, and sometimes we'd be gone a couple, 3 days. And one time we were back there about 10 miles. We went up on these goats up on this ridge, and there was about 6 yearlings laying down. And we just passed a great big old monster that we hadn't want no part of. Here's these beautiful little yearlings all sitting there. So Jimmy said, I'll take the one on the right, and you take the one on the far left. And when I shoot, you shoot. So anyway, when he shot, I never got a shot. They took off. He missed. Some way, he never misses, but he missed. So anyway, they ran and he jumped off this cliff. So I run over and look down off this cliff and I see a goat down there about 30 yards and it's 1,500 feet straight down to the bottom. But anyway, I see this goat and I'm looking straight down on him, so I thought it's one of them yearlings. So it's all happening really quick, so I just shot him right in the back of the head and he goes all the way down 1,500 feet. So I told Jimmy, I got one of them yearlings. So we had to go clean around and down below on this slide to get to him. And here's this bomb crater where that goat hit. And it wasn't a yearling. The thing was a full-grown Shetland pony. It must have been 400 pounds. I'm not kidding. That hoof's this big, and we tried to drag it someplace where we could get it skinned, and we finally got out of that hole, and its insides were just, we ladled them out.
From bouncing down that?
Yeah, it went straight down, and it just hit once in a while, and there was fur. You could see, you know, hair on the side of the wall. But so this goat had one horn left, and it was broke off at about 10 and a half inches. It fractured a few things, but we got it all cleaned up, and we hung it up, and we used the hide for a windbreak that night. We built a big fire. It's a really neat place for a camp, and it was really cold. So anyway, in the middle of the night, it starts snowing, and it snowed, and it snowed, and it snowed. And that next morning, we had 2.5 feet of snow. We had this goat, and I'm not exaggerating. I think we weighed those packs. I think we had 160 pounds of goat meat. So we thought, man, we got a post hole out of here. We're back in this pass way behind McKinley Lake, and this is going to be a job getting out of here. Anyhow, we went about a mile, and there was no more snow. And then we were home free. But
that was a break, huh?
Yes, it was. And then that same night, Weber was cold, so he kept snuggling up closer to the fire. And I woke up once. I smelled something peculiar burning in it. And it's part of Jimmy's on fire. Back of his barn. It's burning. So I start beating on him, you know, and throwing snow on him, and he got mad at me. Well, what are you doing? I said, I'm putting out the fire. You're on fire. Oh, man. So anyway, you haul that meat all the way back here. It was an accident. He was mad at me for killing that monster, you know, and all this. And I said, well, couldn't help it. But we weren't, you know, we had to salvage it. So we brought it back here. You've eaten goats that were in the rut, haven't you?
No.
Well, you start cooking them in here, it'll run everybody out, even the dog will leave. But we're not going to waste it, so we tried everything to cook in that. Finally, there was a children's home here. So we took it down and gave it to the children's home, and they raved about it. They ground it all and put it in chili beans. They were so happy, and we were happy that they got it. Do you want to hear another goat story?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I was trapping from here to 27. Jimmy was trapping 39 to 52, and we never saw each other because he had a cabin out and stay out there. But we were still partners. During the winter, I would still go out there and see him when I could make it. We went and get some meat, so goes over the mountain. There's a big billy there, a monster, and he's about 10 feet or 12 feet from this nice little kid. So Jimmy takes a 243 and he shoots the kid. The bullet ricochets some way, and a piece of it hit the big old billy in the neck. So he had to kill him. So he got to bring him back. He is a monster. He's probably in the record book. They bring the meat out, and we ate half of that kid. We ate both hams at one meal. Mm. We were so hungry. So Jimmy has all this big old goat hanging up outside the cabin. Well, he took the loins and put them in a pressure cooker. Every time he's in camp, when he turns the stove on, he'd boil that in the pressure cooker and put meat tenderizer in it. And he said every day it was the same. It's just like a baseball. He tried to eat it. You couldn't eat it. So he had it hanging outside the cabin for about a week. And a wolverine come one night and took it down. Took it about 50 yards and left it.
Wolverine wouldn't want it either.
That's true. So one time we were sitting down drinking coffee down at the club bar in the restaurant. And Jimmy and Jack Birch and I and a whole bunch of us there talking about goat hunting and brought up the subject of tough goats. And Jimmy told this story about that goat. And Jack Birch is sitting there. And after Jimmy got through telling this story, Jack says, I got one tougher than that once. And those guys almost had a fist fight over it. Toughest goat.
How about a most memorable deer hunt?
It's about, I just went to Memorial yesterday, Dennis Leary. One time we're fishing silvers on the flats, and it was pretty early in the season, and there wasn't any fish out in the flats. Having coffee and tied up together, I said, heck with it, let's go deer hunt. So we go over to Hawkins Island. We have a little place where I like to go in this lagoon. So we each had our own boat. The next morning we went up on a mountain. I went way up on top of this mountain. And I was walking up this slope way up above timber, and I saw where a deer had been feeding on these deer violets, fresh, really fresh. And I was going along, and all of a sudden there was this dead hemlock shrub about 30 yards in front of me, and I saw this buck laying under there, and he took out of there like a shot. It was the biggest deer I'd ever seen in my life. I couldn't believe it, and he got away because I had my gun on my shoulder. I wasn't alert. So I went back down, and I told Danny, I said, I saw the biggest buck I've ever seen in my life, and I'm going back there tomorrow and get him. Anyway, I went back up there next morning, and he wasn't there, right? I thought he'd be, exactly. So I went up on the ridge and I just looked down this middle, and there he is sneaking away. Wham, got him. So I went down there and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't drag him. I could carry a 150-pound buck on my back at the time. I couldn't drag this deer. I took my sling around his horns and tried to drag him. I couldn't drag him. I cut him in two and I packed half a mouth. I don't know what he weighed. And then when I got back, Denny had a forking horn. Regular, ordinary forking horn, probably weighed 130 pounds, no sweat. We lifted the half of my deer. The front half weighed way more than Denny's forking horn. But since that time, because of that, we bought a scale. Since that time, we've weighed quite a few big bucks around. I mean, they're unusual around here, 172, 175 field dress. And then we've weighed, one of my boys had one about 201. And last time I went deer hunting with Jimmy, he got a little baby spike that weighed 197. It was a spike, and it was an old, old deer, you know. And we used to call him. I still got my deer calling. I call lots of deer.
One of the downsides to calling deer is that you can call bears in, too. You ever have a problem with that?
No, I never called bears, but what I have called is owls and magpie. Hawks will come. Owls will come really good, but I never did call a bear.
Now, we haven't talked much about bears, but being around here all these years, you certainly must have lots of experience.
Yeah, I did. I shot point blank, killed Brownie. I had a colonel in the Army and was hunting up the head of Nelson, and we were up there about 15 miles. We had a camp up there, three wall tents. Anyway, we went across this river bear hunting in the morning, and the river was down, and that afternoon we tried to get back to camp, and the river was up. It was getting dark, so we went up and down the other side of the river trying to figure out how to get across. So anyway, we were up across from this moraine with no brush, and all of a sudden I heard something, and I looked over there about 40 yards across to the river, and there's a sow running around circles, clicking her teeth and roaring. And she had three cubs, two-year-old cubs. And I told this guy, don't move, be quiet, don't do nothing. And the wind's going right to her. In that country up there, nobody been hunting for years, someplace where no people around. All of a sudden she saw us, and she jumped in the water and come swimming across. On our side is solid timber and brush. She goes downstream. I didn't do nothing until she got halfway across. I yelled, get out of here, bear. Well, anyway, she goes down the river, and then I hear her coming back, and she's clicking her teeth and roaring. She's coming running through the brush, and I couldn't see her until she, from here, the refrigerator. I had an odd 680 grain, and I shot her right square point blank in the chest. She's a big sow. When I shot her, she just turned her to the side, and she went into the brush, and I told that guy, it's getting dark, and those cubs were big. So they went right with her. I went and looked, there was blood everywhere. I said, she's dead, but we're not going in there tonight. And Denny heard the shot. He was on the other side, the same guy I hunted deer with. And he come running over to on the other side of the river, you know. And finally we got across, and I told him the story and everything. So we waited till morning. Early in the morning, went up there, and those cubs had been eating on her. She was deader than a mackerel, you know. She went about 100 feet. We were going to skin her out for fish and game. She was slipped, you know, already. So I couldn't skin her out because it wasn't any use, but I cut her claws up. And those cubs, they were cruising around. I told this hunter, I said, I can't concentrate on what I'm doing. Take a shot over the tree or something, scare them away. So she did. It snowed that night. Next morning, went in there again, and the other bears had taken her about, oh, maybe 200 yards and eaten her up, a big bear. Eventually, they ate those cubs, too. That bear measured, I think it was 40-some inches of shoulder. It was a big sow. The day before that, I'd stalked that same bear, but I didn't know it. Farther up the creek, the same hunter and I saw this bear in a creek out on the moraine, just its back sticking up. There was a little tiny bit of skiff of snow. We were sneaking over there, and we were 100 yards of her. And I knew it was a 7.5-foot bear. And I says, don't shoot. I'm not sure about this. I see cub tracks around there, you know. All of a sudden, a couple of those cubs jumped up on the bank where we could see them. And I said, let's get the hell out of here, because we're 100 yards of this sow. And so we did. So anyway, after all this happened, I wondered why she was so mad. She had one broken canine, front canine, but I didn't think that was a problem. So we go back up to where we'd seen her the day before. This great big bear we called Super Bear, his tracks were there. He moved in on this little creek where she was feeding with these cubs, and she took off, you know, And I think she was really mad about that. That's my theory. That big bear, we never could get him. We got bears up there, but this damn bear, you could see him off a mile, you know, he's so big on the moraine, and you couldn't catch up with him if he was walking. You know, you'd run. One hunter almost got drowned because he tried to cross a glacier creek. He got so excited, he almost drowned because he wanted to get that bear.
How big do you figure he would have been?
Oh, he's a good 10-foot bear. I've been in on a couple 10-foot bears. I shot one myself, 10-foot. I'm not really into, but years ago I did shoot a big bear out here.
That brings us to the end of today's program, but don't despair. We still have more of our interview with Larry Critchin of Cordova. We'll start next week's episode of Alaska Tracks with more of his great stories. See you then.
It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.